Why didn't anybody go to jail? A financial crisis story in three parts starts today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 26th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do something a little different on the program today, tomorrow and Thursday too. Actually, we're going to pick up on a thread from an interview that we ran almost a year ago and see where it leads us. Back in March of last year, I sat down with Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, and Tim Geithner, Fed Chair, Treasury Secretary, and during the financial crisis, President of the New York Fed, in that order. We talked for about an hour, the three of us, about the crisis, about how we got there, and what the three of them did and didn't do to keep the economy from going all the way under. And at one point in that interview, I said this.
The number one question I get, and I'm sure you three get as well, when I go out and do things, we actually asked our listeners for what they want to ask you three. Number one is, why didn't anybody go to jail, which we'll get to in a minute. But number two is, why did you let Lehman Brothers fail?
I never did get back to that first question, and you noticed.
One question I was most interested in hearing an answer on was not asked. Why didn't anybody go to jail?
Why is it that there were no convictions?
Not one banking executive or mortgage-backed security trader served any jail time.
Somebody was cheating somebody.
Somebody or some groups should be held responsible.
Did I miss that question?
Don't let this subject drop.
So we decided we were going to go find the answer. And in three parts this week, we're going to lay it out for you. We talked to academics and judges, former prosecutors, regulators, and politicians. We talked to them on background and on the record. We read court documents and regulatory filings. And you know what? The answer, and we're going to show you how we got there. We're going to do some history and show you how other financial scandals were handled and explain why 2008 was handled differently. But the answer to why nobody went to jail, it's really complicated. Part one of this story starts with this guy.
I'm very proud of the homeownership opportunities that Countrywide has provided for over 20 million families.
Angela Mozilla was the founder and, during this congressional testimony in 2008, the CEO of Countrywide Financial.
I'm equally proud of the 39 years of success that we have had as a company. But there is no question that the past 6 months have been horrific for many of the homeowners that we serve, for our shareholders, and certainly for our employees.
By the time of the crisis, Countrywide was one of the biggest mortgage lenders in the country. It had a reputation as a savvy lender that had made it through a whole handful of recessions and downturns.
So if you need a lender who actually finds ways to make loans, call Countrywide. We're America's number one home loan lender. No one can do what Countrywide can.
It was a profit powerhouse, and CEO Angela Mozilla was seen as one of the most innovative financial executives out there, listed as one of the best CEOs in the world by Barron's Magazine. Michael Winston had been doing corporate strategy for big companies for years, Motorola and Merrill Lynch among them, before he was recruited to Countrywide in 2005 to be its chief leadership officer. You're going to hear, by the way, that his voice is a bit rough. He's been fighting laryngeal cancer.
First of all, for the first 18 months, we were hitting grand slammers every day.
Back before the economy fell apart, Winston thought Countrywide was the company to join. And then he caught on.
I think I sensed certain things pretty early, but didn't know them.
Winston remembers one time, been there about 8 or 9 months, and like any other day, he'd parked in the executive parking lot and walked toward his office.
And I passed a car with a personalized plate that said Fundum.
Another Countrywide executive walked past, and Winston says he may or may not have been the owner of the car with a personalized plate that said Fundum. He's not sure.
And I said, what do you suppose that means, Fundum? And he said, oh, we fund every loan for every customer.
And he thought, wait a second, every customer?
And I said, what if the guy is jobless? Fund him. What if the guy has no money?
Fund him.
What if the guy has no assets? We still fund him.
Winston asked his colleague while standing in that parking lot, how do you decide who gets a loan?
And the guy looked at me smugly and he said, if they can fog a mirror, we'll give him a loan.
If they can fog a mirror, we will give them a loan. Winston says he was asked to falsify a report to Moody's, the bond rating company, about Countrywide's corporate governance standards. Were you asked to commit fraud on behalf of Countrywide?
Of course. But basically, I said, I understand what you're asking of me, but I can't do it.
Then what happened?
I can say it short and sweet. Retaliation in every way you can imagine and many ways you cannot imagine.
He became a whistleblower, and eventually Winston says he was marginalized and let go. A jury in California heard his story. It awarded him $3.8 million in damages for wrongful termination. That verdict was overturned on appeal, citing lack of evidence that Winston got fired because he blew the whistle on Countrywide. But the court didn't dispute his account of being asked to lie or that Countrywide executives turned against him when he refused.
And, you know, I co-founded a group called Bank Whistleblowers United, and we're still trying to, we keep showing evidence of not just civic fraud, but criminal behavior. No one wants to hear it.
Bank Whistleblowers United includes a whistleblower from Citigroup, also one from the Federal Home Loan Bank Board from back in the savings and loan crisis. William Black is his name. You're going to hear him later in the story. And their informal motto is, we saw something, we said something, and then things got strange. Eventually, as the housing market proved that not everything can keep going up forever, Countrywide found itself at the very center of the subprime mortgage meltdown.
The pink slips were flying at Countrywide offices in Central Florida.
After it nearly collapsed into bankruptcy as its financing dried up, in January of 2008, Bank of America agreed to buy Countrywide for $4.1 billion.
Bank of America executives say they got Countrywide's mortgage business at a good price, since the company's stock value has fallen nearly 90% over the past year.
In 2009, the Securities and Exchange Commission filed a 53-page complaint against Angelo Mozzillo, as well as against Countrywide's chief operating officer and its chief financial officer.
A former executive whose company became synonymous with the subprime mortgage crisis was charged by federal regulators today.
Saying that they deliberately misled investors about credit risks to build and maintain the company's market share.
The government claims that in 2006, Mozzillo knew Countrywide was engaged in risky lending practices and headed for collapse.
The SEC charged Mozzillo individually with insider trading for selling his Countrywide stock for nearly $140 million in profits. The complaint included internal emails from Mozzillo talking about one of his company's profitable subprime products as toxic. In October of 2010, the SEC announced a settlement.
CEO Angelo Mozzillo settled civil fraud charges brought against him by the Securities and Exchange Commission last year.
Mozzillo didn't have to admit or deny wrongdoing. He did agree to a lifetime ban from serving as an officer or a director of a public company, and he was fined $67 million. And then in 2011, the United States Attorney for the Central District of California decided not to file criminal charges against him. We contacted Angelo Mozzillo repeatedly to get his side of this story, by the way. He never responded. So why'd we start there with Countrywide and Angelo Mozzillo? Well, we started there because he was one of the biggest name CEOs who ran one of the biggest subprime mortgage lenders, who was caught doing the wrong thing, who the Justice Department decided not to prosecute. So let's call that the end of the beginning of this story, because I told you when we started, it is complicated. And to really understand why the response to the financial crisis of 2008 wasn't to put people in jail, you kind of have to understand what prosecutors used to do when corporate America started playing fast and loose with the rules. Exhibit A is a little thing called the savings and loan scandal.
William K. Black, associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, also a white-collar criminologist and former financial regulator. I started with the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which regulated savings and loans, on April 2nd, 1984. And this was just after people had decided that the savings and loan crisis had largely been dealt with successfully.
But
the conventional wisdom was that the crisis had been serious but was largely past. And that proved to be a conventional wisdom like many that was completely wrong.
The savings and loan crisis of the late 80s and early 90s and the financial crisis of 10 years ago have some common roots. Manipulation of the financial system that let the banking industry make huge profits while shifting risks to the taxpayers.
The savings and loan debacle, as it was called, was a tragedy in two parts. The first part was interest rate risk. And that meant that savings and loans were going to be hurt very badly if interest rates rose sharply. And they did in the early 1980s when Paul Volcker, as chairman of the Federal Reserve, raised interest rates to unprecedented levels to try to break an inflationary psychology.
So here's what happened. When Volcker raised rates, and he raised them a lot, too, the federal funds rate was 20% in June 1981. 20%. It's 2.5% today, by the way. When Volcker did that, bank customers noticed. SNL customers noticed. And they started moving their money out of savings and loans, which had rules on the amount of interest they were allowed to pay. But over time, as those regulations on SNLs were loosened, those interest rate limits were dropped. And then, because reality, the thousands of savings and loans in this country, once upon a time the safest of financial firms, they started getting into a bunch of riskier things, like commercial real estate lending and junk bonds. Savings and loan deposits, as it happened, were insured by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, FISLIC, it was called. So depositors kept putting their money in savings and loans, risks or no risks.
By mid-1982, on what's called a market basis, savings and loan industry as a whole was insolvent by roughly $150 billion.
Too bad, then, that FISLIC, the insurance fund, only had $6 billion in it.
That's the first act of the crisis. The second act of the crisis was the one that was highly disputed and that we played such a major role in that decision of how to figure out what really went wrong. What turned out to have been gone wrong was fraud, and not fraud by little people, but frauds led by the CEOs.
Ultimately, there was a bailout, an estimated $124 billion, and there were congressional reforms. But before any of that happened, the Justice Department and banking regulators realized there was no coherent system for letting prosecutors know about possibly criminal conduct. So they came up with something called suspicious activity reports, also known as criminal referrals. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board, where Bill Black worked, also a member of Bank Whistleblowers United, remember? The Home Loan Bank Board had its people meet routinely with their DOJ and FBI counterparts to get feedback on every high-priority referral that was made. But, Bill Black says, they lacked a sense of urgency.
So we realized that the only way we could get the Justice Department to provide the resources to prosecute large numbers of these felons was by embarrassing them. And so we made public every month to the media how many criminals referrals we had made that month. And we made an enormous number of criminal referrals. We made over, just one agency made over 30,000 criminal referrals. And so pretty soon, the Washington Post would start running stories going, hey, there are 3,000 criminal referrals and only 8 cases of prosecutions. What's going on? And each month it got worse and worse and worse. Collectively, we got over 1,000 felony prosecutions just in cases designated as major by the Justice Department.
The FBI had 1,000 agents looking into all those SNL referrals, almost 5,500 criminal investigations, 1,000 criminal prosecutions, 800-plus convictions. Charles Keating Jr., his Lincoln savings and loan cost taxpayers almost $3.5 billion. David Paul, he was sentenced to 11 years in prison for his role in the $1.7 billion collapse of SunTrust Bank. 1,000 SNL prosecutions.
All the federal agencies combined in the great financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis, made fewer than a dozen criminal referrals.
Let me say that again. 1,000 prosecutions during the savings and loan scandal, less than a dozen criminal referrals during the financial crisis. Between the SNL scandal and our crisis in 2008, there is one more thing, one more bit of history that we need to give you so you can understand why nobody going to jail for the financial crisis and the Great Recession was so unusual.
Good evening. The stunning collapse of Enron.
Enron was the financial crisis before the financial crisis, a scandal that in 2001 put corporate governance and accounting fraud once again in the headlines.
The giant energy trading company that went quickly from being a darling of Wall Street and a major player in American politics to the subject of a federal criminal investigation.
Enron's bread and butter was building power plants and natural gas pipelines. It became much better known, though, and much richer because of its creativity. It wound up doing everything: trading, broadband, commodities, and data management. It was named America's most innovative company by Fortune magazine 6 years in a row. But it was all a sham.
The big accusation against Enron is its use of shady partnerships to hide debt.
A sham powered by creative accounting.
A top company executive said, "I am incredibly nervous that we will implode in a wave of accounting scandals."
And it did, in December 2001.
After sending most of its Houston workers home shortly after noon today, Enron says it'll notify them whether or not they ever have to come back after filing for the largest U.S. bankruptcy case in history yesterday.
20,000 jobs and $2 billion in employee retirement funds just disappeared.
On Wall Street today, the New York Stock Exchange suspended trading in Enron stock. It said the company's securities were no longer suitable for trading.
The regulatory weak link that time was corporate accounting standards. So the Justice Department set up the Corporate Fraud Task Force. Paul Pelletier was part of that crackdown. By 2002, he was acting chief of the fraud section in the criminal division at the Department of Justice. In all, he was a federal prosecutor for 27 years.
The Enron Task Force was based out of the fraud section. And what happened was in 2002, they began the Corporate Fraud Task Force. The Corporate Fraud Task Force was designed to both missionize, train, and empower prosecutors how to prosecute this new type of accounting fraud, which hadn't been prosecuted before at the Department of Justice at such a high level and certainly hadn't been prosecuted to the depth that it was occurring out there in the market. And as a result of all the prosecutions we did, both in the fraud section and nationally across the country, we prosecuted in excess of 750 executives that had participated in the accounting fraud scandals that occurred in the early 2000s during what people would call the Enron prosecutions, Enron-type prosecutions.
Virtually every top executive at Enron was indicted. Most went to prison.
Former Enron chiefs Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were convicted Thursday of conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud.
Jeffrey Skilling, by the way, was just released from prison after 12 years last week. So here we are, at the doorstep, basically, of the financial crisis of 2008. And after the SNL scandal and Enron, there was a pretty well-established template for dealing with financial crises. Investigate, prosecute where called for, update the rules and regulations, and watch out for the next time. The American economy all but collapsed in 2008. Millions of people lost their jobs and their homes. Lives and institutions were changed in ways that endure to this day, but nobody went to jail. So tomorrow, in part two of this story, what changed? What changed indeed, we will tell you over the next couple of days. There is more, by the way, on the history of financial crises, a character list of the people you are going to hear from tomorrow and Thursday, a recommended reading list as well if you're really ambitious. Also, you can hear the whole three-part series right now. It's at marketplace.org. There is some non-jail news on this Tuesday, but first, let's do the numbers. Kind of appropriate, right? Sad music. Dow Industrial's down 33 points, about a 10% today, closed at 26,057. The NASDAQ slipped 5 points, less than a 10%, 75.49. The S&P 500 down 2, barely changed, really, 27.93. Home builders stumbled. Government figures released this morning show fewer homes built last month than at any time in the past 2 years. D.R. Horton and the Pulte Group chipped off 0.4%. Lennar pushed down 0.3%. Macy's moved up 1.4% today. The department store operator unveiled a major restructuring plan, trimming management jobs, beefing up the chain sales through its mobile phone app. JCPenney rolled up 2.4%. Telecom operator AT&T grew 0.2% today. Federal appeals court gave green light to its $85 billion merger with Time Warner. The Department of Justice said it will not appeal that appeal. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There were some subway problems in New York City today. By some, I mean quite a few. And by today, I mean all the time. What to do about mass transit problems in the most economically important city in this country, though, is what's news. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, and the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, who are none too fond of each other, by the way, have found common political ground on something called congestion pricing. They want to charge drivers a yet-to-be-determined fee when traveling through Manhattan's central business district, the southern end of the island, basically below 61st Street-ish or so. The money, and here's why we mention it, is going to go to fixing New York's beleaguered subway system. And the whole idea of congestion pricing could be a revenue model for other cities as well. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
New York has actually been kicking around the idea of congestion pricing for years. Traditionally, it's a tax to change behavior, to push people to drive at off-peak hours when the fee's lower and roads are less busy, or maybe forgo the drive altogether.
To shift people to other modes, bikes, scooters, transit, buses, etc.
Alex Bayan heads the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Berkeley.
They will not only maybe push people to other modes, but it will also make sure that while they're on the road in a motorized in a vehicle, essentially, they will be spread more efficiently.
In New York, this is also about generating revenue for the city's transportation authority and its ailing subway system.
Taxing those vehicles to improve the transit system to give people alternatives to driving is a good thing.
Steven Schlickman is a transportation consultant in Chicago. He warns getting buy-in from residents is important, as is figuring out the right pricing scheme. New York's plan still has to be approved by state lawmakers. If it moves forward, other cities will be watching, says Mitchell Moss, director of the NYU Rudin Center for Transportation.
Just as New York led the way with banning smoking, other cities are going to say, is this a revenue system which we can use to finance our own infrastructure?
Cities like Los Angeles and Chicago are already looking into congestion pricing programs of their own. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There is a corporate story of note today. Home Depot reported disappointing fourth quarter sales this morning, said CEO Craig Menear about the last couple of months. It was cold, it was snowy, and perhaps worst of all, it was wet. Blaming weather in part for weaker sales? Oh, that's been in the home improvement playbook for years, as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
Home Depot's fourth quarter covered the months of November, December, and January, a period when meteorologists were throwing around terms like polar vortex and telling people to brace for lots of snow and rain. Hannah Hayes at Kantar Consulting says often retailers use the weather as a scapegoat.
But I think when you think about this space in particular, it is really unique because it can have an impact.
We tend to think of farming and ranching as being more susceptible to weather than retail, but Home Depot says people don't do as much home improvement, even on the inside of their homes, when the weather's cruddy. But Laura Champagne, an analyst at Loop Capital, says it's not just the weather that's to blame for Home Depot's underwhelming sales.
They blamed less than 1% of the miss on weather, and that does make sense, but they missed by more than 1%.
She says Home Depot's recent miss is more about the slumping housing market than wet weather. And no matter the weather, Home Depot may be in for a tough go.
We're at the start of a cyclical shift, and that's something that the housing data point to as well. It's typically not a blip. It's typically more than 1 or 2 years of tougher results from the Home Depot.
But the weather can also be a boon to home improvement stores. Home Depot's sales typically spike when people have to rebuild after hurricanes and other natural disasters. And the retailer says it's investing in technology to forecast the weather, which helps it know what products to stock, how much, and when. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, a follow-up to the interview we aired yesterday with former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, the news-making part of which went like this.
Do you think the president has a grasp of macroeconomic policy?
No, I do not.
As it happens, current Chair Jay Powell is scheduled for some testimony this week on Capitol Hill. The Senate Banking Committee was this morning. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, had a question.
Thank you. Thank you again for being here, Chairman Powell. Yesterday, your predecessor, Janet Yellen,
said she doesn't think President Trump has a grasp of macroeconomic policy. Is she right?
I won't have any comment on that for you, Senator.
All right. Guess I'm not surprised.
Well, there you go. If you happen to have missed that interview with Janet Yellen, or if we are going to be preempted tomorrow where you live for that Michael Cohen hearing that's happening up on Capitol Hill, you can catch it on our podcast. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials down 33 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ off 5, less than a 10%. S&P 500 basically unchanged. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platt, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Mutti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.